From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. Last week, the Senate passed sweeping new telecommunications legislation, with final approval by the House slated for July. On today's Fresh Air, we consider the likely impact on the industry and the consumer with Ken Auletta, communications columnist with The New Yorker. Also, The Liars Club. We talk with Mary Carr about her new memoir of her childhood, haunted by her family's myths and secrets. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Michael Jackson's new CD, History, which collects his past and present work. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton says he's pleased that a majority of senators support a chance of a vote on Dr. Henry Foster's nomination as Surgeon General. Mr. Clinton says he'll try one more time to break a filibuster led by Texas Republican and presidential candidate Phil Graham. It takes 60 votes to stop the procedure, and today's vote was 57 to 43. The president says those who voted to continue debate aren't voting on Foster's qualifications, but rather on abortion.
This should be about whether the president has a right to make this decision if the person is qualified. The committee ruled that he was. The only other question worth asking and answering right now is, are we going to try for another vote? Yes, we are. Do I know what the outcome will be? No, I don't. But I'm not through yet.
Dr. Foster thanked President Clinton for his support, as well as those senators trying to bring his nomination to a vote.
To you, Mr. President, for your firm and unwavering support of my nomination. Thank you so very much. I would also like to thank all in the Senate who have stood by me and worked tirelessly to allow me a chance to be heard by the full Senate.
One more vote to end the filibuster will be taken tomorrow at noon Eastern Time. A deal between the Algerian government and the main Muslim rebel opposition party is reportedly near, NPR Sunni Khalid reports.
According to the Algerian newspaper La Liberté, an agreement is near for releasing two leaders of the banned Islamic Salvation Front. Front President Abbasi Madani and leader Abdelkader Hachani would reportedly be freed with about 600 other Muslim militants on July 5th, Algeria's 33rd independence anniversary. In exchange for the release of its leaders, the front would agree to a ceasefire in the country's three-year-old civil war. Last year, Madani and his deputy, Ali Belhaj, were placed under house arrest as part of an attempted dialogue with Algeria's military regime. That effort collapsed and the men were returned to prison after they allegedly called on their armed supporters to step up their offensive against the government. An estimated 40,000 people have been killed in Algeria since 1992. That's when the military regime canceled multi-party elections that would have brought the front to power. I'm Sunni Khalid in Cairo.
Japanese police have stormed a hijacked jumbo jet in northern Japan. They reportedly captured the hijacker and rescued the 364 people aboard. The hijacker had apparently threatened to blow up the plane. He was demanding the release of the jailed leader of a religious sect held in connection with the gassing of the Tokyo subway system. Authorities in Ramona, California, say at least three people have died in the crash of two firefighting planes. The California Department of Forestry says the planes crashed into a home. Ramona is east of San Diego. Witnesses say the smaller plane appeared to clip the tail of the larger plane. On Wall Street, the Dow is down nearly 2 points. This is NPR. The Supreme Court has upheld a restriction on lawyer advertising. The vote was 5-4. The court upheld a Florida rule barring attorneys from soliciting business from accident victims or their relatives for 30 days after an accident. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The Florida Supreme Court adopted the 30-day blackout on lawyer solicitations after the Florida Bar Association conducted a study showing that these solicitations were viewed by the public as an invasion of privacy. 2 years later, a company that sent out solicitations challenged the rule. The company claimed it violated the First Amendment guarantee of free speech. In recent years, the Supreme Court has consistently struck down limits on truthful lawyer advertising, but today the court, by a 5-4 vote, upheld the Florida rule. Writing for the court majority, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said that since lawyer advertising is commercial speech, it has less protection under the First Amendment, and that since the Florida rule was justified by an unrebutted study and was narrowly tailored, it is permissible. In a stinging dissent, Justice Anthony Kennedy accused the majority of complicity in a censorship scheme. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
The bodies of two American missionaries kidnapped in Colombia last year have been found, shot to death. Police say the bodies were discovered near a site where rebels and the army clashed just a few days ago. The army says it seems Timothy Van Dyke and Stephen Welsh were shot in the head and buried in a shallow grave no more than 24 hours before their bodies were found on Monday. Men were kidnapped by leftist guerrillas in January 1994. An environmental group says a lot of garbage turned up on the nation's beaches last year. The Center for Marine Conservation's released a breakdown of the nearly 3 million pounds of waste that volunteers picked up during the 9th annual beach cleanup day last year. A group spokeswoman says nearly two-thirds of the trash was plastic. The group is fighting changes to the Clean Water Act. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. If you think it's hard to decide which long-distance phone company to use, just wait to see what happens if Congress finalizes its telecommunications reform package. Last week, the Senate approved the first major overhaul of telecommunications law since the 1930s. The bill would deregulate the local and long-distance telephone industry, cable television, broadcasting, electric utilities, and wireless communications. It does away with most limits on cable TV rates and raises the number of radio and television stations an individual or an organization can own. The House is expected to vote on a similar measure later this summer. My guest, Ken Aletta, is the communications columnist for The New Yorker magazine and the author of Three Blind Mice, a book about the major television networks. He says it's hard to predict where all of this deregulation would lead.
Not clear. Once again, we're jumping off a bridge. We don't know whether there's water underneath or how tall the bridge is. I mean, you could make, there are two models for the future. One model is that the big guys, the Time Warners and the Rupert Murdochs and the ABC Cap Cities and the Telecommunications Inc. and the AT&Ts and the Seven Baby Bells, that those big giants will become bigger and will be able to buy up other operations all across America and become these giants. That's one model. The other model is that by allowing these industries, in effect, to compete against one another, the model is you're going to have more competition rather than less competition, and that competition will serve the public. We don't yet know which model will prove true. You can make the argument that if the first model proves true, the greater concentration of power in the hands of fewer and fewer media giants, that the antitrust laws could be put into effect to curb that.
But in order
to do that, you need a government big enough to bring an antitrust suit.
Exactly. The Justice Department can't always handle all the caseloads, and their antitrust laws and their enforcement don't seem quite adequate in this case to protect the consumer.
But the argument that those who favor deregulation are making, they'll, for instance, point to the computer industry and say, look at what happened to IBM as the model here. That IBM, Big Blue, was once the giant megalop, you know, this giant company, all-powerful. And today it's not. You have many new computer companies that are in business, and the prices of computerization has gone down dramatically, even as service and computer power has increased. So that's one model. The other model is the breakup of AT&T. They argue that if you look at what happened there, we've had a burst of new competition. In part, that's true, the new competition with AT&T and that the Baby Bells have gotten in that business, but the Baby Bells are essentially a monopoly. That monopoly, the argument goes, will be challenged now by cable companies that will get in the telephone business, by the wireless companies that are in the telephone business, so that you will have a model of competition. We don't know which model will prove to be the case, but there are dangers, obviously.
Well, one thing that seems to be clear is that the bill lifts regulation of cable rates, and that cable rates, at least in the short term, will go up. Is that how this greater freedom is going to bear on the consumer?
I think you have to look at long term, short term, and the answers may be different. In the short run, the odds are that cable prices will go up in the very short run. I mean, the cable companies feel they have not been able to charge a rate increase and have not been able to invest comparable to the investments being made by the telephone companies that are trying to get into their business. So there's going to probably be some rate increases in terms of cable. But in the intermediate run, that is to say, not the next year or two, but the next 5 years or so, and beyond that, the odds are that what happened in the computer industry, if competition is the same in, say, the cable industry, that prices will go down.
You know what my fear is as I'm listening to you? My fear is that if this deregulation reform passes and becomes law, that I'm going to have to make decisions based on all this technology that I don't understand, that I'm going to have to figure out what would be the best way to go, whether to get my TV from cable or to go with the telephone company or to... Right now, I can barely decide about long-distance carriage. What do you think will be the fallout then for the consumer?
I think the consumer, this is a profound change in our lives that we're embarking on here in terms of the way consumer technology will impact on consumers. It may well be that in 10 years, your TV set will be your computer screen. And you'll interact with it through your keyboard, or maybe it'll be your telephone model, or maybe your wireless instrument will be what they call a personal digital assistant that you carry around that is a combination of portable phone, and you're talking about something that fits in the palm of your hand. That's a combination of portable phone and fax machine, and word processing system and TV screen all in one, using again the wireless technologies. But there will be big changes, but we have to make choices today on a more mundane level on what credit card company. You know, we get all these mailings, what the interest rate will be if you switch credit cards. As you mentioned, you get it with your long-distance services. It's just that we're going to be hit increasingly with these choices, and we're going to have to become more sophisticated, or if we choose not to be sophisticated, and some would say we would choose to be Luddites if we so make that choice, we'll turn to our kids. And our 9-year-olds are going to know, and they're going to say, hey, Dad or Mom, you know, get with it. You should be looking at a Compaq or a Hewlett Packard or whatever. And you know, maybe they'll say, why are you buying a VCR that's separate from your personal digital assistant, that's separate from your television set, that's separate from your phone system, that's separate from your CD player? You can put it all in one instrument. And there's a new one out now at the Wiz. You should go down and look at it. I'll come with you, Mom or Dad.
So that's the advantage to me, that my phone company is going to get into cable, and that the cable company will have its hand in the phone service, that eventually I'll be able to have one thing in my house that will do all that?
Well, that's a potential advantage, but that's not the main advantage. The main advantages for the consumers would be, one, that your prices might come down, and might come down dramatically. That's a possibility. I mean, they have come down dramatically in, say, long-distance service, and they have come down dramatically in regard to computer costs. I mean, you look at what it cost. When I first bought a Hewlett Packard printer, it was probably $2,000 for that printer. That same printer today is about $300, and it's a better printer. And so that's, you do benefit from competition. And also, as the market expands, mass production allows you to shrink the cost and therefore the price you charge a consumer. But one advantage for a consumer potentially is dramatically lower prices. Another advantage for consumers is the much heralded notion of viewing on demand. Instead of you waiting for a scheduled NPR at a certain hour of a certain day, or waiting for Murphy Brown at 9:30 on Monday night on CBS, or 60 Minutes at 7 on Sunday at CBS, you could choose to watch what you want to watch when you want to watch it, so that your schedule, you dominate the schedule, a network doesn't for you. And that's a great potential advantage for the consumer. Now, there's also a disadvantage, which they tend not to advertise, which is that every time you watch outside of what's free broadcasting, as say the networks is free broadcasting, but the assumption that many of these business people are making is that we will enter a pay-per-view world. That is to say, you want to watch a tape, basically what you could do on your VCR, but you forgot to tape it, so you call up a service and you say, hey, I want to watch Superman tomorrow night. I missed it Sunday night on ABC. They say, great, $2.99 or $1.99. And maybe then if you have advertisers sponsoring the show and you're willing to allow advertising, maybe it'll be 99 cents. But essentially, they're going to charge you for watching things in this 500 or channel or more universe that they're speaking of. It's a pay-per-view world. You can get movies on demand, but you're going to have to pay for them.
Ken Auletta is my guest. He's the communications columnist for The New Yorker magazine. Let's take a short break now, and we'll be back to talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ken Auletta. The bill also allows electric utility holding companies to provide some telecommunication services. So while we're talking about all this new technology, let's talk a little bit about smart houses. I could probably, if this passes, rig my house so that I'd use less electricity at peak hours, and I could automatically turn off my appliances when I'm out or busy. That sounds pretty good. And for decades, I think futurists have been predicting that we'll all live in smart houses like this. So do you think our houses will finally be smart?
Well, I think potentially they can be. And, you know, one of the great questions about the future is, what is the intelligent agent that will be the interface or between us as a consumer and the instruments in our home? What will make it user-friendly? For instance, they perfected the remote control switch so that it is user-friendly. Everyone, no one complains they can't use a remote control switch. It's very simple. And it's had a profound effect upon viewing and on attention spans of people. I mean, I think you can make an argument when you talk to teachers that one of the great evils in the society in terms of their ability to get the attention and retain the attention of children is that remote control device. And kids are so used to switching off things that bore them. And that happens often in classrooms today. But essentially, if you could find a replication of that remote control device so that it's user-friendly, and it may not just be a device, it may be voice-activated. It may be that you're going to walk in to open up your refrigerator and start talking to some chip that's going to record your what you say, and you say, need a gallon of 1% milk, dozen large eggs, you know, a small filet mignon, a boneless breast of chicken, and then you press a button and you get your order sent to the supermarket. And they know it's you because your chip portrays your address and your account number. And an hour later, it's delivered to your home.
It's the Jetsons. I'm curious, though, and this is a question that you raise in your series in The New Yorker, just how much interaction Americans really want, whether there is a market for all of these fancy interactive services.
Don't know. It's unknowable. The truth of the matter is we are jumping off a bridge here, not just in terms of telecommunications legislation, but in terms of what the assumptions are. The assumption that many people make who speak of this brave new world of 500-plus channels, or really one channel where you can get anything you want anytime you want it, or the convergence of your computer and your telephone and your TV and your VCR, the assumption is that that the public doesn't want to just sit and be passively entertained, that they want to work a little bit, and they want interactivity. They want to scroll through the 500 channel choices, and they want to select for themselves, be empowered to make their own decisions and talk on the internet and open up communications with people all over the world. That's the assumption that is commonly accepted today. That may not be true. I mean, it may well be that at the end of a day, most people, I'm not saying some people, I'm saying most people may just want to collapse in front of the TV set and let someone else do the work for them.
The House will probably consider the bill in July. What do you think the law will eventually encompass? If I can ask you to look in your crystal ball, what do you think will survive? What will get the axe?
Well, I think they will raise the limits that broadcast networks will be allowed and television group owners will be allowed to own more TV stations than they're now currently allowed. They're now allowed to own 12 TV stations reaching no more than 25% of the American populace. That will increase to probably 35% of the American populace. The limits on how many radio stations you may own will also be increased. The telephone companies will be free to get into the cable business. The cable companies will be free to get into the telephone business. The power companies will be free to get into anyone's business, as will the wireless companies. So you will have a situation where potentially you will have more than one wire or wireless means into your home, and there will be competition. That, I think, will probably pass this year. What effect it will have on the public, whether it will actually in the long run or intermediate run lead to lower prices, it's an act of faith, not an act of fact.
One of the concerns people have about a more interactive world is that these corporations, not only will we have a lot more choice in what we will view or what kind of information will come into our house, but a lot of information about us is going to go out to them. And there are many people very concerned about privacy issues in this.
I think privacy is a profound issue. What they're doing, the assumption that many of these companies make, and, you know, technology allows you to have that box on top of your TV set, for instance, is becoming a very powerful microprocessor, basically a computer, a camera in your home that records everything, what shows you watch. And if you do your banking through that, it will record where you spend your money. If your credit cards come through that, include all your bills. So essentially, as we move more towards this interactive future of using this device to do many things, including shop with, right, someone will be collecting a lot of information about us. What happens to that? Again, you get back to what is government's role? I mean, I want government, and I think many Americans do when they think about it. And part of the job is to ventilate these issues so they can think about it more than perhaps they've thought about the telecommunications legislation that's before the Congress. You want the government to protect your privacy. For instance, if you go into a Blockbuster store, which is now one out of five video stores in America is a Blockbuster, they have enormous amount. They have the most extensive consumer research about every one of their customers. They know what movies we've rented, what our likes, what actors or actresses we tend to be partial towards. They know some credit information about us. Are they allowed to sell that information? To who? With my permission or without? You've got some big questions here. One of the great advantages that a company has who has control of that box, let's say the cable company, is they have access to all of their customers' preferences. Any advertiser would die to have access to who. Let's say that, for instance, I'm Budweiser, right? Wouldn't I like to know who the beer drinkers are so that I could target my advertising and not waste a lot of money on ads to everyone? Just target it at people who we know are beer drinkers. Great advantage. Do I want the cable company to sell that information so I'm bombarded by the equivalent of junk mail? Boy, I don't know. But then they're going to come at you. You know how they're going to try and induce you as a customer. They're going to say, All right. If you give us access, if you allow us to sell information about you to advertisers, we'll cut in half your telephone or probably your television bill, because advertising will pay for the shows you watch. So instead of spending $3 for a movie, you'll only have to spend $1.50. And then you confront people with the tough choice. Give up my privacy for saving some money.
So who's going to protect us? I mean, Ralph Nader doesn't have $40 million to sink into lobbying efforts for the next telecommunications reform.
The analogy of playing a football game without a referee is the one that stays in my mind. That is to say, you would no more consider putting two gladiator teams on a field to try and bust each other's backs and tackle and grab without a referee to call the play dead, to call a foul, to stop action, to call an offside. You would never consider playing a game without a referee. Well, you can't play this game where you have nine industries basically each trying to kill each other without a government referee. The problem is that you want to have it so that the government referee doesn't play the game themselves. You want them on the sidelines, but you want them to have the whistle in their mouth.
So do you see the House putting some of these revisions into the bill, or do you see this issue rising again in the public eye and then in Congress in five years from now, or 2 years from now, or 20 years from now?
The issue will rise again, because what happens is that what often happens when you have dramatic reform legislation, as this is, inevitably the realization will sink in. Did some good things, but we went too far. We have to make some mid-course corrections. And one of the mid-course corrections that will be made, I think it's fairly safe to say, is to say, hey, we need some more. We need to beef up the government referee. Maybe it's the government referee in regard to the privacy. Maybe it's the government referee in terms of prosecuting, you know, monopolies or just enforcing the antitrust laws that are already on the books that are not affected by this legislation, but they are affected by the legislation. If the Justice Department isn't beefed up, or in fact, if you scale back the enforcement division of both justice and, say, the FCC, then there's some real question whether you can do the kind of investigation that allows you to determine whether there is a monopoly or there is restraint of trade. So I think it's probably safe to say there will be some mid-course corrections after the legislation is passed, if it is passed. And there's probably a lot of, in the heat of the moment and the euphoria of the moment about, you know, the new totem, which is deregulation, which makes a lot of sense. And I don't sneer at that notion of deregulation. But nevertheless, what's often forgotten is that to do these things, to ensure fairness, there will be a need for a referee, and that maybe this legislation goes too far in crippling the government referee, and maybe goes too far in avoiding the traditional notion, which is an important notion, of what is the public trust.
Ken Auletta, I want to thank you very much for talking on Fresh Air today.
Thank you.
Ken Auletta is the communications columnist for The New Yorker magazine. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up on Fresh Air, the new CD by Michael Jackson. Ken Tucker has a review. Also, poet Mary Carr talks about family secrets. Her new memoir is The Liars Club. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton's nominee for Surgeon General Dr. Henry Foster has been unable to get his name to the Senate floor for a confirmation vote. Texas Republican and presidential candidate Phil Gramm is using a filibuster to block a vote. Several Republicans oppose Foster, who performed abortions during his career as an obstetrician-gynecologist. They also oppose him for not clearly stating how many procedures he performed immediately. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole says Foster is the wrong man to be America's doctor because Foster didn't tell the truth right away.
Some explanation made sense and some didn't. Some questions were answered and some were not. And somewhere along the line, I think a line was crossed where no matter how hard Dr. Foster tries, there'll always be questions in the minds of many Americans about this nominee's candor and credibility.
President Clinton denounced the continuation of the filibuster. He says the Senate did a disservice to democracy by denying Foster a chance at a confirmation vote. One more effort to end the filibuster will be made tomorrow. The government reports the nation's trade deficit grew much worse in April, the latest month for which figures are available. The trade deficit has reached a high of nearly $11.4 billion. Part of the problem was a surge in Japanese car imports. The Commerce Department report shows the deficit jumped 16% in April. Imports rose to an all-time high while exports dropped. Japanese car imports climbed 9.5% to a new level of $2.4 billion. The Los Angeles Raiders football team may be returning to Oakland for the upcoming National Football League season. Kathy McAnally reports.
The Raiders abandoned Oakland for Los Angeles more than 13 years ago. Raiders owner Al Davis was unhappy with the facilities available at the Oakland Coliseum. Since then, Raider boosters, including many Oakland officials, have been working to effect a reconciliation. Time after time, it's been said that Davis is sincere about moving his team back to Oakland, but the deal has always fallen through at the last moment. Today, television commentator and former Raider coach John Madden told a San Francisco radio station that the team's really coming back, that the details will be announced tomorrow. A Raiders spokesman in Los Angeles called reports of the move strictly premature. With the departure of the Rams for St. Louis, the Raiders are the sole NFL franchise in Los Angeles. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy McAnally reporting.
Reports say the lawyers for two suspects charged in the Oklahoma City bombing want separate trials. USA Today reports a defense strategy for both men charged in the case will be to blame each other. The lawyer for suspect Terry Nichols says prosecutors want to make the defendants appear to be equally involved. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow fell 3.5 points to end at 4,547. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin says Israel's redeployment of settlers from Palestinian population centers will cost $700 million. He also estimates it'll take almost a year to complete. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Senior Army officers today asked Israel's Finance Committee for about $100 million to begin building roads for Jewish settlers that will circumvent large Palestinian towns on the West Bank. Rabin said he visited two small settlements where it will cost $250,000 per family to build the roads needed. Israel is offering a two-stage withdrawal with Palestinian elections after the first stage, but PLO leader Yasser Arafat says the withdrawal from all population centers must happen before there can be elections. The two sides hope to reach an agreement by July 1st. Meanwhile, Palestinians today staged a general strike in solidarity with hundreds of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails who are on a hunger strike to demand their freedom. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
North Korea has agreed to accept 150 tons of rice from South Korea after 5 days of secretive talks. It's the first time the North's communist government has officially decided to accept emergency food aid from its southern capitalist rival. The North stresses self-reliance as a main focus of its ideology. The announcement signed today is expected to spur Japan to announce it will also give food to the North. The North had asked Japan last month for emergency food aid. It was the first admission of a food crisis. Japan agreed to help, but decided to hold back shipment until the North accepted South Korean aid. President Clinton has named White House Communications Director Mark Guerin as the new director of the Peace Corps. The president made the announcement at a White House ceremony today. The Peace Corps was founded by President Kennedy. Mr. Clinton says Guerin will continue the tradition of service Kennedy started. If Guerin's confirmed, he'll succeed Carol Bellamy, who now heads the UN program UNICEF. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Mary Carr spent her childhood in an East Texas town that made Business Week magazine's list of the 10 ugliest places on the planet. In the early 60s, when Carr was a child, Beaumont, Texas was a refinery town. And as Carr writes in her new memoir, The Liar's Club, the sheer stink of my hometown woke me before dawn. The Liar's Club was what the women called a group of local men who gathered at the American Legion Hall to drink, play dominoes, and to tell stories. Mary Carr's father was the undisputed champion at telling these tall tales. And though Mary delighted in her father's exaggerations, she would later learn that there were much more serious lies buried in her family's past. Mary Carr has published 2 volumes of poetry, The Devil's Tour and Abacus. She teaches literature and creative writing at Syracuse University. The Liar's Club opens with the night Carr's mother had a nervous breakdown. She says that her mother never quite fit into small-town life.
She drank beer in the front yard. She breastfed us. You know, that was scandalous. She was a newspaper reporter. I mean, that in and of itself, to work... I was born in 1955, and to have a job when you had a babies, it was outrageous. And there she would sit on the front porch drinking beer, and with me attached to her breast, and some guy made a crack about it. And she also had on shorts. I remember that was a big thing at the time. And you've got a picture. It's like 105 degrees, 100% humidity. It's below sea level. Just miserable, sodding, evil, hot. I mean, people would pass out. If you went outside and ran around, you'd just fall over. And he said something about her, that it wasn't Christian, or made some comment about it. And she said, you'd see evil in the crotch of a tree. You know, I mean, she was also mouthy, you know, and outspoken. And
2 things women aren't supposed to be.
Even today, I think people are often surprised by that.
Well, she sounded ahead of her time, but she also made a household for you that wasn't just quite plain normal, is how you put it. Apparently, you all ate dinner sitting on the bed in the master bedroom, all facing opposite walls.
That's a strange. It only seems strange now. I discovered, and it was only in college that I discovered that people kept their clothes on in the house. You would come into the house. I mean, it was partly practical because it was so hot. You would come in and you would take your clothes off and pat around in your underpants. And I remember going to college and coming home from an 8:30 class, 9:30, and putting on my nightgown, and other people in the dormitory finding this peculiar. So,
did you want to belong to some kind of Beaver Cleaver type family when you were a kid?
Oh yeah, sure. But I also, in a sense, disbelieved that. I thought other people were just better at pretending. For instance, I thought the other people in the other houses didn't have their clothes on except when I was there. And they did it just for me, to sort of make a nice impression.
So you thought everybody was leading somewhat of a double life?
Yeah. Yeah, I thought they were all liars, I guess.
Well, you write that a lot of people, in trying to figure out what exactly made your mother tick, called her nervous. That's what, instead of words like mental illness or mental disease or depression, everything got labeled nervous. What did you think nervous meant when you were a kid?
Well, I think it could mean anything from chronic nail biting to full-blown psychosis. I mean, it was literally, it was a blanket term. And it's, if you think about medieval notions of mental illness having to do with being possessed by demons, it's not that much, it's very broad-based. And if you're not interested in the subtleties of misbehavior, mental motivated misbehavior, then I guess nervous is as good a term as any.
Your mother's mother might have come under that category at one time in her life, or perhaps her whole life, too. And I'm thinking the way you describe her early on, she showed some signs of being nervous. She sent away for a detective in training kit and collected evidence against her neighbors, dust balls and things, when she'd go to their homes for tea. What was she looking for?
I can't imagine. I'm sure that and my mother's told me this, I'm sure I mistreat my grandmother in this memoir. But she only lived with us when she had cancer, which had gone to her brain. So my knowledge of her character is warped, you know, by the fact that I only spent time with her very near the end of her life. But she was clearly peculiar. I mean, she was always, she made lace. She tatted lace. I don't know if you've ever seen one of those little tiny shuttles that people used to use to make lace. But it takes a real obsessive compulsive, you know, you have to be a little bit anal to tat lace. I think it's hard on a person.
She tatted lace and she kept a hacksaw in her purse.
She had a big purse like a doctor's bag and she kept a hacksaw in it. Don't ask me why. I don't have the slightest idea. My sister remembers it too.
Pretty soon after your grandmother's death, your mother had a nervous breakdown. What do you think really pushed her to her limit?
Well, I think the loss of her mother. And, you know, her mother had been very disapproving of her. Everybody had been very disapproving of my mother. I mean, she was always unconventional. She was unconventional as a child, as a young woman. She was an outlaw, and she was smart and good-looking, and, you know, had these terrible secrets in her past that she had no way really to deal with. And I think her mother judged her as a sort of failure.
Tell us what happened that day and that night that she had her breakdown.
That she set a fire in the backyard and got, you know, they took her away to a loony bin and slam dunked her.
And so. She thought that she had murdered you and your sister.
Yeah. Yeah, she was delusional.
Mary Carr is my guest. She teaches creative writing at Syracuse University. She's the author of 2 volumes of poetry. She's just written a memoir of her childhood called The Liar's Club. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mary Carr. Her new memoir is called The Liar's Club. We keep talking around the history that your mother had, and the book doesn't. Your book doesn't reveal her history until the end in that way. Mm-hmm. It's almost a mystery that you lived as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about her history now. When did you find out about the lies, the secrets that your mother held from you?
Well, I guess I write about it in the end of the book. It was 1980 when I discovered that I had a half-brother and a half-sister by her first marriage and that she had been married a number of times before she was. My father was husband number 5 and number 7. I always knew that she had some sort of past we hadn't been informed about. I mean, it was very mysterious.
What did she tell you?
She liked to talk about being in art school. She liked to talk about, you know, living in New York City in the 40s and going to the Cotton Club and hearing the ink spots. And hearing opera and, you know, El Greco's view of Toledo at the Metropolitan, and a little Chanel belt she bought, she really liked. And so she had, I mean, she had this sort of, you know, glamour about her of that, but it was also, you had no sense of her history. I mean, I knew my father's family, I knew his people. You could go to the town where he had gone to school and meet people who had known him when he was a boy. And with my mother, it was all very remote.
Why did she finally tell you?
I made her tell me. I sort of bent her over double backwards. And she said, okay, I'm going to have to get drunk to tell you. So we went to this Mexican restaurant and ordered pitcher after pitcher. We ordered started off with two pitchers of margaritas. And she sort of told the whole story. And I mean, so many things became clear. I don't know. I mean, hearing about her history just made my whole life clear to me. It sort of made plain to me what was wrong, you know, what the problem was, that she lost these kids.
How did she lose those two children?
Her first husband took them. She had gone to work full time. She was living in New York. And she came home and they were gone.
The whole family?
The lock, stock, and barrel. Every stick of furniture, the radiators were cold. It was a big shock.
And she found them, but much later.
She found them years later, and because they didn't recognize her and seemed happy, she didn't even know she was divorced, but he had somehow divorced her and remarried. And it wasn't until she went with the custody papers that she sort of thought about what it would entail, being a single woman. She was working, but what she would do, how she would support them. And they were also, because she was a stranger and there with the sheriff, they were afraid of her. So she tore up the custody papers.
Why had she never told you?
She had a great sort of sad phrase. She said, "I was afraid you wouldn't like me anymore," which I thought was a sort of sad thing for a grown woman to say, because, of course, you always like your mother. I mean, it's kind of built into the animal that you like your mother.
When she finally told you, did you react? Did you feel angry that you hadn't known? Because, as you say, it made so much sense.
No, I felt angry before, when I didn't know, you know, what was going on. Or what had gone on. And no, I felt relieved. It was like, you know, all the light bulbs went on at once. It was very hard for her, obviously, to tell me. And she was, it's interesting, though. My mother was, as of everybody in my family, she is sort of, she'll lie by omission. But you can't really, I mean, she's not one to really just flat fabricate something. I mean, she, the way my father would have. So it's interesting that, to me, in some ways, she winds up being the ultimate truth teller. But I was very relieved. I think my sister was too. We all were. So was she. She was bathed in relief, to carry a secret like that. And, at that time, for a woman to lose her children.
Unimaginable. Mary Carr is my guest. She's written a memoir about her childhood called The Liar's Club. She teaches creative writing at Syracuse University and also has two volumes of poetry, Abacus and The Devil's Tour. Why did you write a memoir? Had you tried to write about your family in fiction?
I tried to write about it as fiction, and I behaved so well in this novel I was trying to write. I was heroic, I was intelligent, I was resourceful, wise, clever, beautiful.
Barbara Stanwyck.
Oh, it was great. I was adorable. For me, I've heard real novelists, I mean, talk about it, and I think they often talk about being able to tell the truth better in a novel. But for me, it was just an occasion to you know, correct the record. I think the memoir is also by its nature episodic. You know, you expect it to be a series of anecdotes. And so structurally, I think that's more suited to I'd worked writing poetry for 20 years. So the other problem I had writing a novel was I don't know anything about writing a novel or about fiction in general. So I had, however, read an awful lot of memoirs, and I taught classes. I'd always loved the form, and I taught classes in it. And it always struck me that there weren't more, at that time, there are now, women's memoirs of undeniable quality. I'm thinking of, you know, Mary McCarthy's Catholic Girlhood or Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. Those were the two women's memoirs that I found, you know, impossibly moving. But there are all these amazing, for a long time, memoirs by men. And so, I mean, it occurred to me that there was something about family secrets that I might know that I might have to tell.
Well, you said somewhere that every time you tried to write stories, to write short stories, everybody would end up dead by the second page.
Yeah, I didn't have any stamina for it. Yeah, I mean, that's why I was a poet, too. I mean, you have a little, my parents gave me, my grandmother gave me this very morbid little Southern Gothic sensibility, although I don't know that there you can be Southern and not be Gothic. So I had a little dark streak, and this was a story I knew had a whole shape. You know, there was a mystery at the beginning, and I followed that mystery until I solved it, and my entire life changed at that, and so did the life of my family in a way. So
I want to thank you so much for talking with me on Fresh Air today.
Thanks, Barbara.
Mary Carr's memoir is called The Liar's Club. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams joins us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Barbara. On our program this evening, the Supreme Court upholds a ban in Florida against lawyers trying to solicit victims or the families of victims within 30 days of an accident. Nina Totenberg has that story. Joanne Silberner reports on a Federal Trade Commission ruling that will make it easier for people to find out why they have been turned down for health insurance. Elizabeth Arnold reports on the vote today in the Senate concerning the nomination of Henry Foster to be Surgeon General. A vote to cut off debate failed. The issue will come up again tomorrow. Michael Scholar reports from South Africa on the worker hostels in black townships in South Africa. The hostels reflect a way of life that existed during apartheid.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more on All Things Considered on National Public Radio. This week, Michael Jackson releases History, Past, Present, and Future, a double album containing 15 of his greatest hits and 15 new recordings. Publicity for the collection is in full swing. History comes on the heels of a widely seen Diane Sawyer TV interview with Jackson and his wife Lisa Marie Presley. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review of History.
When you see it on the album package, the first three letters of History are capitalized and italicized. Michael Jackson wants you to read this as both history and his story, because the 15 new songs on this collection are nothing if not elaborate, self-aggrandizing explanations of the pain he's endured ever since he was accused of child molestation in 1993. The charges were dropped, and on History, Michael is full of bitter recrimination.
Kill me, do me, sue me, everybody do me, kick me,
That song is called They Don't Care About Us, but what he really means is You Don't Care About Me Sufficiently. Jackson is insulting the converted, castigating his fans for following the tabloid reports of him, for having the gall to wonder whether their hero is weird, perverted, or both. In reaction to this, Jackson throws a tantrum. In fact, he throws tantrums all over history. This is the dark side of that childlike nature he's constantly presenting us with, and on this song, his infantilism is especially repellent. Jackson had barely released the album before he also issued an apology for the phrases Jew me and kike me, which he said was his way of, quote, saying no to racism. Now, you don't have to have contempt for Jackson to think that this is pure malarkey. You and I can admire him as a genius pop musician. The evidence is right in front of our ears on the greatest hits section of history, in songs like Beat It, The Girl Is Mine, and Don't Stop Till You Get Enough. But no matter what sort of genius he is, and no matter how difficult his childhood was, another key subject on history's new songs, he can't continue to get away with acting like a child who's just learned some naughty words, or in this case, some anti-Semitic ones, and is using them for shock effect, to get attention.
Have you seen my childhood? I'm searching for the world that I come from. And found of my heart. No one understands me. They view it as a strange eccentricities. Cause I keep kidding around like a child.
In the past, Jackson's wide-eyed guilelessness was alternately charming or annoying. On history, it becomes grotesque. Jackson no longer has any subject that interests him except his own innocence, in both a legal and emotional sense. He's intentionally stunted his creative life to remain this way. Because so much of his new material is full of hostility sprinkled with four-letter words, his audience of real children is bound to be confused. And because so much of it is sentimental treacle, the audience that has grown to adulthood with Michael Jackson now finds his refusal to put away childish things ridiculous, embarrassing. History, his story, has reached a dead end.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Michael Jackson's new double album, History. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Kathy Wolf, and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Terry Gross returns tomorrow. I'm Barbara Bogave.
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking. When there are in the sky, you'll get by if you smile with your fear and sorrow.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Plume Paperbacks, publisher of A Whole New Life, An Illness and a Healing by Reynolds Price. This is NPR, National Public Radio.